Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the Strike and Ellicott Files, an unofficial podcast dedicated to all things Cormoran Strike, as written by Robert Galbraith. My name is Kenz, and today Lindsay, Pools, and I will be continuing our reread of Troubled Blood, this time for chapters 60 through 62. As always, please be warned that our discussion of Troubled Blood will reference events that occur later in the book, as well as previous books in the series. We got some interesting and exciting news about the filming of Troubled Blood. Lindsay, do you want to tell us a little bit more about that?
I guess it's kind of an unofficial announcement. This guy on Twitter, his Twitter handle is at DodgerFanForLife9, posted. It looks like a clip from TV Guide, doesn't it?
Almost, yeah.
A little blurb, I guess, saying that the status of Troubled Blood is January 2022. I tried to independently verify this. I couldn't, but Bill from Strike Fans figured it out where he's getting this information. And it's coming from a website called productionweekly.com. And you can see on their homepage that the current newsletter has Strike in it, but you can't click it unless you subscribe. And the problem is even the cheapest subscription is $75 a month. I know, it's insane.
Holy hell.
So I was like, well, we're not doing that. But that is where he got this information. So I have no reason to believe it's not true.
Mm-hmm. But no confirmation that it is true either.
Right, no confirmation. I feel like I remember Tom Burke or someone saying that they thought that that's when it would be, but I could be making that up. I hope it's right. I really love seeing the press pictures and finding out who's playing who. So it's exciting for me.
I'll have to keep an eye out on that Bronte Twitter account and see if they post anything. As far as feedback goes for the last episode, we just want to say we are so grateful for all of the wonderful responses that we've gotten. They were really great. Y'all were just fantastic. And we're so glad that you guys listened to it. In some cases, listened to it twice.
That is amazing.
Yeah. Because like that wasn't even just one person. There were multiple people who responded and said, I'm on my second listen. This was so great. So thank you to our listeners.
Yes. Thank you.
And then we had a few other things that we wanted to talk about too.
Yes.
Well, I had some feedback of my own, if that's allowed.
Am I getting a performance review? Is that what this is?
Are you ready?
Pools, maybe not as bad as Sarah Shadlock.
I've been thinking about what you said, actually, about Gillespie.
Oh, okay.
I was already there, but I feel like you really put that final touch with a great potential motive.
Yes.
Just to recap really quickly, your theory is that Gillespie was embezzling money from Strike's child support account and Leda found out about it and therefore Gillespie killed her.
Yes, that's roughly what I think the motive could have been.
Okay, so here's what I've been thinking about is how Leda would have found out about that. And mm-hmm. I started thinking about the part in Career of Evil where Strike is thinking about Whitaker. And it's in chapter 10. It starts on page 59 in my book and it says, Whitaker had entered the squat under the clear impression that it was part of Leda's style to dwell in impoverished Bohemia, but that somewhere nearby was a vast pool of money into which Strike and Lucy's fathers, Johnny Rokeby and Rick Fantoni, respectively, were pouring money. There's more. It talks about the pressure that Whitaker would put on Leda for the money, the lies he would tell her to try and get it, how he refused to believe that she didn't have access to it, and then how Strike was horrified when they got married. And it ends with, yet it had happened, undoubtedly because Whitaker thought it would be the only sure way to get his hands on those mysteriously hidden millions.
Mm.
So what you're saying is when Strike turned down the money at 18, Gillespie started taking money from that account. What I'm suggesting maybe is that Leda also began looking into the money after learning Cormoran didn't want it. Was it because the pressure from Whitaker? Maybe she figured if he's not going to take it, why shouldn't I? I don't know, but given what we've learned about her, I think it's possible.
I think it's totally possible that Whitaker would have kept the pressure up and increased the pressure on Leda to get his hands on the money. I think he could have even stolen access to the account somehow, to be honest.
One of the reasons I've never thought Whitaker killed Leda is because that's what Strike thinks happened.
Yeah, the rules of mystery writing.
Yeah, but if Whitaker was aware that Leda was looking into this, and therefore he also knew about Gillespie, one theory I'm tossing around in my head is that Gillespie and Whitaker teamed up. I don't know how strong that is. I'm thinking it's more likely that Gillespie killed Leda and then found out that Whitaker knew about him. And so Whitaker's blackmailing him.
Maybe. Whitaker's family weren't the ones who stumped up for the fancy lawyer to get him off in court. Maybe that was part of the payoff from Gillespie. Just came to me as a possibility.
Yeah. I mean, I would personally really love to see Whitaker brought to justice for anything, but it would be really satisfying if it did have something to do with Leda and that mm-hmm. strike could potentially solve that. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It's just this money has kind of been hovering throughout the series, but we haven't been fully aware of it until now. Mm-hmm. It's interesting to me because these two characters, Gillespie and Whitaker, are not connected in any way to each other, except they both have an interest in this money.
It does make an odd team up that you wouldn't expect, which is why I think mm-hmm. it's plausible, right? Gillespie and Whitaker together, but you're right. They both have an interest in the money. And I know Cormoran would get on us for considering motive before means and opportunity. But I think that you could make a plausible argument that they both, between them, had plenty of means and opportunity.
Yeah.
I like it. I think it's super plausible. And as much as I love the out there theories, like, you know, Lucy actually killed Leda, I do think that Gillespie did it is like one of the most likely theories. So finding a plausible motive and a possible Whitaker connection makes it even stronger.
One of our listeners, Kurt, sent me a link to an article he wrote on Hogwarts Professor, and he argues that Gillespie is the real villain, and he makes some really great points about this money. I'll link to it in the show notes, but he mm-hmm. says, you know, we're led to believe by Strike and by Lucy and Cuckoo's Calling that Rokeby is behind Gillespie hassling Strike for money. But he points out at the end of Cuckoo's Calling, Robin, when she's on the phone to Gillespie, says, oh no, Mr. Strike's adamant he wants to pay off the loan. Well, that's very kind of Mr. Rokeby, but Mr. Strike would rather pay, implying that it is not, in fact, Rokeby who wanted the money back.
Mm-hmm.
So Strike's probably playing into Gillespie's hands here by refusing the money yet again.
I can imagine that Gillespie was quite relieved for Robin to say that over the phone, if this is in fact the case.
Yeah.
I definitely believe it was Gillespie behind the aggressive hounding for the money to be returned. And it would fit with this whole theory.
Kurt also pointed out in his article that J.K. Rowling is hiding crucial information among all this romance and tension in chapter 58, which she does so well.
Absolutely. And that's why I think it's so important to pay attention yeah. to the stuff in this chapter and in other chapters. We should be paying more attention to the plot stuff in these chapters when it does happen.
It's hard to do.
Yeah, really.
But yeah.
I like it.
We're starting part 6, and there is a bit of an epigraph here. It says, so past the 12 months forth, and their due places found. Their year is up.
It's been a whole year in this book. Wow. So in chapter 60, in the aftermath of the whiskey night and Morris being fired, Strike comes to realize that he is not going to be able to get into the nursing home to interview Mucky Richie anymore. So the epigraph, fortune, the foe of famous chevissance, seldom, said Guion, yields to virtue aid, but in her way throws mischief and mischance, whereby her course is stopped and passage stayed.
So this one's interesting for me. When I was doing the epigraph interpretations page for Strike fans, I looked up this word chevissance because I didn't know what it meant.
It's an obsolete word.
Yeah, and I found a Wiktionary page that said it derives from the old French word chevir, I think that's how you'd say it, which according to the page means to finish or complete.
Yeah, the word chevir does, but the chevissance, which derived from chevir, but didn't mean it meant to help or remedy.
But what's interesting is that the page says that Edmund Spenser used it incorrectly in this passage, and he meant it to mean chivalry. So I guess what the epigraph is saying, or what he meant it to say, is that chance is the foe of chivalry.
Mm-hmm.
In this chapter, Strike is still adamant that Robin stay far away from the Ricci's. Something she later wonders is misplaced chivalry. So I think this epigraph is that Strike is trying to be chivalrous and do this himself, but his bad luck caused him to be unable to.
I thought it could also be sort of in reference to their reflections at the beginning of the chapter, that their sort of chivalrous adventure between Strike's sheets was interrupted by chance. Their progression forward has been stalled by Barclay in the form of Fair Fortune, throwing mischief in their way.
Strike and Robin start off the chapter rerunning the conversation that they just had in their head and wondering whether or not they had said too much and what the other was thinking. To me, I think this is just hilarious. They really don't say much, but this feels like a huge revelation to them, and they're dummies, and I love them so much.
Yeah, it says they're both preoccupied with it.
Mm-hmm.
It's just Robin's heart thumping and Strike all antenna all over again, because they both know what was happening in that room, but it's the first time they've actually talked about it. So it's something they both can't stop thinking about.
I like that it says it was over the weekend. So more than just the morning after, the whole weekend, we know Strike was running surveillance. I guess he probably wasn't thinking about much else while doing that.
No, probably not. And it says that they both wonder whether too much was said or given away, but I think we can assume they only mean by themselves. Because they both desperately want the other to give more away and to say more, but they somehow are afraid that the other doesn't want that from them.
They're both afraid of upsetting the status quo, and both afraid of what would happen if their feelings were revealed for slightly different reasons, I think. But yeah, they're each afraid that their tongues were loosened. I think we've all had that night after too much whiskey. We're like, oh my God, what did we say? Did we do something that we're going to regret? Yeah.
Now that Strike is sober, he was glad he hadn't done what the whiskey had said to do, because he might be in a state. Yeah, I hope you heard my air quotes around that. He might be in a state of bitter remorse with no way back to the friendship that was unique in his life.
Yeah. God, I can't imagine trying to have a first kiss or, you know, anything past that with a busted up face. Like, oh, ouch.
Yeah. There are more romantic first moments, I think, that we'll hopefully get. Although knowing these two, it'll be even worse when they do finally confess or kiss. It'll be in some ridiculous situation that we can't have even imagined.
I don't know if I fully agree with what he's saying. I do agree with you that it wasn't the right time. So I don't want Robin to be in pain either.
Yeah.
And I want them to be less afraid, but I don't know if he's right that they necessarily be in a bad place already. I think that's his fear talking. If we're looking at this statement from a place of his fear, which is that once you step into a romantic relationship and even possibly use the word love, it all goes wrong. He's not worried that he'd be remorseful and can't find a way back to their friendship because it didn't go well. I think he's thinking that the bad would already be coming in, which is wrong. Especially when he just said that Robin's friendship is unique in his life. I think it just really gives some insight into maybe how quickly things would go downhill with Charlotte once he went back.
I agree with all that. I like picking apart this sentence for the tiny little grammatical tells where he says that he might be in a state of bitter remorse. I think that that's sort of him acknowledging in some part of him that actually it might have worked out and he might be deliriously happy for the rest of his life at this point, in the same way that he had to be glad that he hadn't done what the whiskey was urging. He had to be glad. Seems to me like he's not actually glad. He sort of grudgingly acknowledges that he supposes he's happy, but in actuality, he's still kind of really annoyed with Sparkly for interrupting them.
I mean, same.
Yeah, I feel like this sentence is just hedged in a really interesting way where I just don't know how genuinely glad he is to have been interrupted at this point. I think it's less than he's trying to convince himself that he is.
I just also love how he describes their friendship as something unique in his life.
Oh, I love that. So sweet.
He makes me wonder if he ever considered Charlotte a friend.
I highly doubt it.
Yeah.
I don't think that she occupied that place in his life or his heart or mind or anything. It echoes for me Robin at the beginning of Lethal White saying that her friendship with Strike was one of the prizes of her life, which gets me every time I read it, because oh my goodness, Robin, how is she acknowledging that and still not acknowledging the feelings she has for him? But it's such a good line, and I like that it's echoed here. I mean, they echo each other all the time. There are all kinds of parallels in the way that they think and the way they phrase themselves.
He wondered if Robin knew how close he'd come to pushing the conversation into territory that had previously been fenced around with a barbed wire, or if she knew that he had been wondering when he last changed the sheets.
Ooh.
A couple of things stick out to me here to kind of piggyback off of what Clara said about enchantment in our last episode. Obviously, she can't read his mind, but like with all of the other unspoken moments between them, he thinks it's possible that she could read him and just knows what's going on in there. Kind of tells us how much is actually said in these unspoken moments.
And he's not wrong, is he? In these specific moments, she can sort of read his mind. How can these two be so good at reading each other sometimes and so absolutely terrible at reading each other other times? Like Robin constantly thinking she knows what Strike is thinking about firing her or about her being late or whatever. She projects all her insecurities into his mind and gets him completely wrong. And Strike being paranoid about Robin getting pregnant or dating Morris when the exact opposite is true.
It's because they read each other correctly when they're trusting their gut.
Yeah.
And when they second guess it, it's their fears talking.
Their fears take over and they get it wrong.
Going back to Robin's thoughts, Robin went back over everything she'd said to Strike, hoping she hadn't betrayed any of those feelings she habitually denied even to herself.
Aww.
I love how many times in this book, this is at least the second, I need to check chapter 45. It might be more, where Robin is admitting that she's hiding her feelings for him. Yeah. She hasn't actually outright admitted that she has them, but this is pretty close to an admission, right? Yeah.
I mean, it's implied. It's implicit. She wouldn't have feelings to hide if she didn't have feelings. Logically, hiding them means she knows she has them. She's just trying to pretend to herself that she doesn't. I really hope we get her at least stop hiding from herself. Like, sure, keep a lockdown with everyone else, but I hope we get to see her actually acknowledge what's in her heart.
I will die when that happens.
Oh, me too. Yes. I mean, I feel like I'm going to be dying for most of the next book. Let's be real. If it's going where I think it's going, I'm already dead. I'm just podcasting from beyond the grave over here.
She's thinking about Strike telling her she was his best friend a lot, because it says that the memory called a little spurt of happiness every time she returned to it.
Aww.
It just gives me this image of her just kind of smiling to herself as she goes throughout her day.
Yeah.
But then, you know, other emotions come in where she wished she had been brave enough to ask him directly how he felt about Charlotte.
Mm.
I mean, what she's really saying is she wants to know how he feels about her.
Yeah, she wants to know if she has a chance. And that's all tied up in how he feels about Charlotte, how he feels about her.
Because she remembers what happened the last time she tried to figure out what he felt for her.
Yeah, that's probably really influencing her insecurity here. The last time she directly tried to find out what Strike felt for her, she caught Coco on the phone instead.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's a really good point, Kenz.
Because it did affect her like a hard slap. She doesn't want that again. And now she's got to sit here and deal with all these feelings. And she wants to know, but she doesn't want to know.
And in the meantime, Charlotte's living in her head completely rent-free.
Yeah, I love the way that's described as an image of Charlotte permanently hung in her head.
Mm-hmm.
It's a wonderful description of someone taking up space in your mind. And it also reminds me of in Cuckoo's Calling when Strike goes to get his things from Charlotte's place and that portrait of hers on the wall kind of haunting him. This portrait all over again of her haunting Robin now.
That's a really interesting parallel.
It also says that the image of Charlotte had taken shape since they had passed each other on Denmark Street way back then.
That is a lot longer than your boss's ex should be living in your head, Robin.
We've talked about this before, how she wasn't attracted to him then. She didn't have romantic feelings yet, but I think you've said a possessiveness before, Pools.
Yeah, she instantly felt very possessive of Strike. She instantly wanted to know more about him. I think she was drawn by him being a bit of a puzzle, wasn't she? Maybe.
Maybe she saw herself in him too. I just really want to use the word soulmates or fate or destiny right now.
I love the word soulmates, and I will never apologize for calling them soulmates, because they are. They're two, basically two halves of the same person. Like, literally, there have never been two people that fit together so well.
This point that you make here, Lindsay, about how the image of Charlotte in Robin's mind had become stark and fixed the night before, so a quote-unquote darkly romantic vision of a lost and dying love breathing her final words in Strike's ear as she lay among trees.
It's such a contrast to how Strike saw that moment. Robin is really romanticizing this as if it's some grand gesture of love for him. Mm-hmm. It almost makes me wonder if she's thinking about when Charlotte came to him at the hospital. Is she worried that it's going to be that in reverse, that Strike is now going to go to her at her lowest ebb?
Oh, I hadn't thought of that before, but it actually makes a lot of sense.
We know it's in her mind because the next she says, Strike had once, when extremely drunk, told Robin that Charlotte was the most beautiful woman he'd ever seen. And as she hovered between life and death, that beautiful woman had chosen to contact Strike to tell him she loved him still. So she's thinking about it.
Yeah, she is.
They need to talk about Charlotte so bad.
She's just so wrong about what this moment meant and what Charlotte was to him. I guess she worries that Charlotte is what Strike wants. Because she knows 16 years on and off, that's got to be what he wants, right? That's got to be what he's drawn to. That sort of dramatic, romantic, beautiful, exciting, tragic love story. She doesn't know that that's not what he wants anymore. Consciously wants.
I like this next quote that we have here that's continuing on in this vein. God, I just feel so bad for Robin. What did prosaic Robin Ellicott have to offer that was in any way equal to such high stakes drama, such extremity of emotion? An up-to-date Rhoda, neatly docketed invoices and cups of strong tea?
Silly Robin.
Does she not realize how much that means? We could offer even more things like, hey, calm from emotional storms. No drama.
A voice on the phone that makes everything seem less awful every time he hears it.
If your cups of tea are a way of showing you care, and also being that, you know, you're the true two of cups, like you said, yeah, it's something wonderful to offer.
Yes, we know that he loves the way she makes his tea. He thinks about it all the time, all the time. It's one of the things that he notices and likes about her. And he also loves working with her. He loves running the business with her. Her Rhoda and her invoices are what saved the business partly and what helped it to grow. And so, like, yes, Robin, you do actually have a ton to offer. And also, I'm pretty sure that in the 5 books I've read, you have also been involved in a lot of high stakes drama and extremity of emotion with Strike. So I don't know that your relationship lacks excitement.
This is probably the closest we've seen to her fully saying that she wants a romantic relationship with him. What do I have to offer that's better than Charlotte is pretty clearly saying that.
It is.
Yeah. And it's a nice callback, this point you made here about back to the cups of tea and Robin holding two cups. So I don't know. I think you may be onto something there with the whole cups thing.
I like that. I like that it also seems that in a very British sense, the suit of cups is basically just cups of tea. And that seems like a very English interpretation of the tarot. She is the real two of cups, though. Robin is the two of cups. They are the soulmates.
Later on, her mood keeps wavering between diminishing cheerfulness and a tendency to brood. But then she ends up giving herself a stern talking to. Strike had given her an unprecedented assurance of affection, and she'd never have to see Saul Morris again, and she should be delighted about both.
I'm delighted about both.
Me too. Although she actually does have to see stupid Saul Morris again, unfortunately.
I've been trying to convince herself to only feel happy over him telling her she's his best friend. The reason she can't feel happy is because that's not what she wants with him. She doesn't just want to be his best friend. I think there's also maybe a touch of disappointment that nothing happened.
In the same way that Strike has to feel glad, she has to feel happy, but she kind of isn't because she wants more.
She thinks about Charlotte so much because that's the place she wants to take in his life. I think it's kind of her version of, I want to be the main woman in your life.
Oh, she so does. I just like this bit because Robin starts off with, doubtless because of the pain in her face. Sure, Robin. Yes, it's definitely the pain in your face that's making brood on Charlotte and Strike in your feelings.
Not anything else.
No, it couldn't be anything else. And we get some good Pat stuff, which I love. I laugh every time she shows up.
Yeah. I love how it describes Pat and Strike as almost colliding, but then talks about how they're both preparing to ingest nicotine. Mm-hmm. I just think this is the start of a turning point in their relationship. And it paints a picture to me that they've been almost colliding this whole book. But then it kind of immediately reminds us of some commonality between them.
Yeah.
I don't know. It might be a stretch, but I do think that this constant colliding with them ends in this chapter.
Yeah, because Pat gets a bit of a wake-up call, which I think was overdue. I do like what you mentioned about their commonality because they do have common ground. They have similarities. And I think that once they get over the initial difficulties they've had in this book, that they'll actually have a lot of fun together. I think they're going to be so funny together when they are more friendly. It'll be entertaining.
I think there's a little bit worth talking about that Strike walks away from Pat after telling her about Morris. And it says that therefore Robin bears the brunt of Pat's disappointment.
Mm.
I think on the surface, maybe you can look at this as another moment where Strike is maybe being rude and Robin bearing the brunt of that. But I don't really think so because I don't think that Strike is in the wrong here. I think that Pat is the one who's being unfair.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not blaming him for this one. Also, a little bit later on, it says that Robin thought, unlike Strike, that Pat should know the whole truth, which leads me to believe that they've talked about it.
I think it's possible that they did. I think it's also possible that that is the narration or sort of the voice of the narrator intruding and knowing both of their thoughts. So Strike doesn't mm-hmm. feel the need to tell her, but Robin, unlike him, does. So I think that's also possible.
Yeah, I agree.
But like you, no, it's not Strike's fault. I think maybe they have different attitudes towards team building, where Strike is maybe, I mean, he is fairly professional. He's very curt and short. And maybe he's like, why do we have to explain to an employee our choices? Whereas Robin's maybe a bit more touchy-feely and says, well, you know, I'm trying to make us all get along. And telling Pat the truth will help with that.
It's also frustrating to me, though, because I know we've talked before that Strike doesn't care what people think about him. But
yeah.
Even when it's good, Strike, part of me wonders if Robin wants to tell her so that it'll make her life easier, because it paints Strike in a good light. You know, it's, he supported her. He was not the creep.
I'm sure that Robin is very glad to be able to tell Pat something that will get her to knock it off with the Morris is so great shtick.
Mm-hmm.
She hadn't had the chance to, because again, team cohesion, you can't go bad mouthing employees to other employees, right? But finally she can say, Pat, he's a creep and I never liked him. I don't blame Strike. He was on his way out. He's giving instructions and remembered one. He doesn't need to sit down and have a therapy session with Pat about it, you know?
Yeah.
I think Strike grudgingly likes Pat. I think he likes that she doesn't like him. I think that's something that endears her to him. I think he finds it a bit entertaining.
He definitely likes her better than the temp that was trying to record him.
Yeah. He has a fondness for Pat, I think, that he won't admit to himself. And it's very grudging. But again, I cannot wait to see their relationship develop and their weird friendship. I think it's going to be so cute.
Well, I think that Pat is real and like honest. And I think that he really values that, even if they're kind of combative and their relationship is a little bit antagonistic. I think that he really likes that. And like you were saying, he finds that entertaining.
As do we all.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like for the same reasons he likes when Robin tells him to fuck off.
This is when Pat calls Barclay that Scottish nutter to Robin.
I just found that Scottish nutter such a funny description that I think it would make Barclay laugh. If she called him that Scottish nutter to his face, I think he'd find it very funny. I just think that it's very clear that Pat has really terrible taste in men, and that maybe she's not the best judge of character, and that maybe this little wake-up call is going to cause her to examine the preconceptions she makes and sort of reevaluate some stuff. But we see that it does, don't we?
Yeah, Pat seems very overly confident to express her opinions with everyone. And
yeah,
sometimes they're not great.
Yeah, but that's what makes her funny too.
Yeah.
So
Pat's hot takes.
Yeah. Please let Pat start a Twitter account or something or a blog. I want to read Pat's hot takes.
I feel like we should start one.
Oh, that would be so funny.
But seriously, though, saying that Strike could take a few lessons from Morris. Pat. Oh, you've got it so wrong.
Yeah, she does. We talked last time about how different Strike is from men like Morris or Oakden, but Strike and Morris are really opposite when it comes to like outward impressions, especially with Pat. She falls for that handsome face and flirtatious demeanor of Morris, but doesn't see him for what he is. And likewise with Strike, she doesn't see him for who he is either.
It really fits with the themes of the novel of getting fooled by how we categorize people. Pat is another one who's putting people into categories based on her previous experiences and missing stuff and getting it wrong.
When Robin says, it wasn't Cormoran who wanted him gone, it was me. Apart from anything else, he sent me a picture of his erect penis at Christmas.
I'm just laughing at what's coming up. Sorry.
I like that Robin felt the need to say that.
His erect penis, like not floppy, just full on erect. His burgeoning.
Oh no.
She's not mincing words. No sugarcoating.
I mean, she just went for the detail there.
She could have just said dick pic.
I know. But
a picture of his erect penis just to really get the point across. Bless her.
Well, I don't know. Does Pat know what a dick pic is? Apparently not.
Apparently not. As we find out. Oh, that's so funny. Can you even finish the quote?
Yeah, Pat's deeply lined face registered almost comical dismay in the post. Robin laughed. What, tucked inside a Christmas card? No, by text. You didn't ask for it? No, said Robin, no longer smiling. He's a creep, Pat.
Oh, the idea of Robin opening a Christmas card and a dick pic Polaroid or falling out is so fucking funny.
I like that you think it's a Polaroid and that he didn't go like get it developed.
He used his photo printer to carefully print out his dick pic and insert it into print.
Merry Christmas, Robin.
You know those cards that you open and it's like a pop-up?
Got a custom card made with the pop-up, sitting there with his crafting knife and his glue gun. Like, I'm gonna make a little pop-up dick card. Robin's really gonna love this. Shows I'm a handyman.
I wonder, was it to scale? I don't.
Knowing men, I'm sure it was like bigger than life size, you know. Oh, that's so funny. I'm getting some ideas for this year's Christmas cards now. I think our family's gonna love it.
Pat thinking dick pics are sent in the mail. On a serious note, Pat doesn't say another word about it after that. Robin had her support, and the only thing Pat says was, should I update the Rota or you? So I liked that.
Yeah, she doesn't try to push it. She doesn't try to say, oh, maybe you misunderstood. Maybe it was an accident. She's like,
she makes no excuses for him.
What a creep. Absolutely unacceptable.
This is when Robin calls Strike.
Robin finally getting to bring up her idea about Gloria to Strike, which was why she was vomiting if Oakden didn't spike the punch.
Mm-hmm. Strike agrees with Robin's theory, and he remembers his own theory from after meeting the Bayless sisters, and he says that if Robin's theory is true, it weakens his. I don't know why this one always trips me up. Remind me what this is, Pulse.
Right. So Strike's coincidences that he noticed after the meeting was that a lot of people connected to the case had been getting sick around that time. So he'd noticed a lot of tummy upsets.
Troubled tummies, you mean?
He noticed the troubled tummies. So his theory was sort of like, what if something is causing these illnesses? Is there a poisoner at work, right? But if Robin's theory, which is that Gloria was actually pregnant and was throwing up because of that, he thinks that's a really good theory, which, to be fair, it is a good theory. Then if that's true, then it weakens his because it takes away one of the coincidental illnesses, right? It means that the punch wasn't poisoned. What I like about here is that actually they're both right. Uh-huh. So Strike's coincidences and his theory is correct. Someone is poisoning people. But Robin is also right that Gloria was pregnant and that she was the one who had the abortion at Bride Street and that Margot helped her get it. So even if Robin did get there from the wrong evidence, she was still technically correct.
I do love Strike's misconception that morning sickness only happens in the morning. He just has no experience with this.
You'd think he'd have noticed at some point during his sister's 3 pregnancies, possibly.
Well, wasn't he gone?
Oh, yeah, he was. So maybe he wouldn't have been around.
And I'm telling you right now, my brothers would have no idea.
That's fair enough. Brothers aren't the most observant of creatures, I suppose. I'm wondering if there's any significance to the fact that this is the second time that we've heard about Hardacre's wife's severe sickness during her pregnancy. Because this is Hardacre, and we know it's Hardacre because Strike thought about it in Lethal White, too, when he thought that Robin might be pregnant. So I'm wondering, this is something that seems to have stuck in his mind, that Hardacre's wife was hospitalized for illness. Is it just because maybe it interfered with the case, Hardacre had to leave suddenly? Or is this something that's going to come back somehow? I don't know how. It is the second time we've heard about this little fact.
Yeah, I don't know, maybe.
Oh yeah, and what Strike is doing lurking out here is he's going to go talk to Mucky Ricci, or at least he's going to try, isn't he?
Yeah, and just, you know, to throw it out there, he didn't run this by Robin.
Mm-hmm.
Just saying.
Yeah.
He doesn't ask her. He doesn't think if I screw this up, they might come for Robin. I'm not saying he shouldn't have tried. I'm just saying that his argument is flawed.
Yeah. So throughout this whole thing with Ricci, Strike is absolutely in the wrong. If he was being rational, he'd have known that Robin was their best shot of getting into the nursing home undetected, and he would have worked out a plan with her to do it safely. But
I have a couple points where I'm going to defend him on it, but we'll save it till later.
Okay, that's fair.
I like this bit that Strike was in no particular hurry to hang up because he wanted to finish a cigarette and would rather do it talking to Robin. That's so cute.
That is really precious. I mean, what wouldn't he rather do while talking to Robin? Pretty much everything, right?
And then he is recognized by his old physiotherapist from Selly Oak.
I mean, obviously this is just a plot point to make it impossible for him to go, but I kind of liked this. Her, look at you all famous, and his Marjorie.
I think it's sweet.
It is. I think there's often a perception of him just always being rude to people, and I understand where that comes from, but I don't think it's completely accurate.
No, he's not always rude. He knows how to be polite. He has people he likes, you know. Yeah. He can be in a good mood and be friendly with people, or even he has, you know, I know it said before, he has the advanced set of social skills that moving around gave him. He can be pleasant, and he often is with people he likes.
Yeah, it's just, you know, people like Lucy's friends who ask rude questions.
Frankly, deserve it. Yeah, of course.
And now they're back in the office, and Strike says, there's no chance of us getting in. Oh, Strike. Also back in the office, though, Miss Jones is on the phone.
She's being ridiculous, as per usual.
It says, put her through to me, said Robin, as Strike mouthed, thanks. I like that he mouths thanks to her. And I wonder if it's because he didn't want Pat to hear, because you know she's probably still judging him that Miss Jones has a crush on him.
Absolutely. We're all judging him for having all of these beautiful women throw themselves at him.
No, I'm Miss Jones, so I can't say anything.
But you have to wonder, though, what on earth was she talking with Robin with for 40 minutes? My God.
She's filibustering. Just keep her on. Say anything. I'm assuming she's using Robin as sort of a free therapist while she waits for Strike.
To get her off the phone, she has to lie and say he's not coming back to the office. And it says it was her only lie of the day, Robin thought. Given that Strike was adept himself at avoiding pledging his own word when he didn't want to, he really ought to have noticed that Robin made no promises whatsoever about staying away from Mucky Ricci.
Was anybody else anxious about what would happen at this part?
Very. Because I was still worried about Brian Tucker and Creed, but this is the moment where I realized, oh no, this is going to be the thing.
Yeah, there's going to be anything they're going to argue about. It'll be this.
I think at this point, I was just racing through it so quickly that I didn't really have time to process things that were pointing at something happening in the future. I was like, oh God, no. I was just really racing to get to the climax of the book at this point.
All right. So next up is chapter 61. And in this chapter, we have Robin visiting the nursing home of Mucky Ricci. And for the epigraph for this chapter, it goes, then when the second watch was almost passed, that brazen door flew open and in went old Britomart.
This is a really perfect epigraph, isn't it?
It really is.
It's a very straightforward epigraph. Yeah, Robin is heading in.
The chapter opens with press coverage from the incident at the American Bar,
which is hilarious.
It did make me laugh because it's such an accurate depiction of how these things are written in magazines and newspapers, right?
So accurate. Well, I'm sure she's had a bunch written about her, so yeah. She knows.
Yeah, she gets it so right. It's so funny. Also, if I was Robin, 100% I would have looked at pictures of this party too, of Rokeby's party.
Absolutely. Yeah, of course she's going to look up pictures. Strike thinks so often about how tactful she is and how she doesn't pry into his history or anything, when in reality, she is the nosiest person on the planet. She just also polite, so she waits until she gets home and like ferrets around on the internet, like any reasonable person does. Absolutely, I'd be Googling that.
Oh yeah, and when it talks about the costumes they wore, it makes me laugh because imagine if Strike had actually agreed to go and then they told him, oh,
by the way, you have to dress up as an 18th century aristocrat. You're going to have to put on skin tight leggings and a great big wig. Oh my God.
It's very let them eat cake, don't you think?
Oh yeah. The party theme gave me very much like out of touch rich people throwing their money around without realizing that the guillotine is sort of waiting for them. Yeah, that gave me vibes. But I'm just, God, if Strike had attended this fictional party, there's no way he would have gone looking sexy in his Italian suit, and he would have made every single one of these rich idiots realize, wait, we look a bit ridiculous. Imagine him in that group photo standing there in his suit and the rest of them around him. Oh man.
Sorry, now I'm just imagining how you described him looking sexy.
In his Italian suit. Now I've short-circuited your brain.
I'm
going to
be thinking about that for the rest of the night. Thanks.
Going back to that blind item, how much do I loathe that it calls Robin his faithful assistant? She is his partner. God, why can no one get this right? I want Strike to get a side hobby of writing in angry corrections to these newspapers, demanding a retraction. Outrageous. Disrespect. How dare they?
That's his wife.
That's his wife. Exactly.
Things are kind of difficult right now. So they're not making a whole lot of headway in the Bamborough case. They're having trouble finding replacements for Morris. And then Barkley and Hutchins have taken time off. So it's just Strike and Robin together again in the office, just like the good old days.
I hope we get more of just them together sometimes. I find it fascinating the way she's writing the agency expand and the way she's throwing in these new problems of how do we deal with employees? You know, how do we deal with juggling a successful business and the plot of the novel? But I did like it when it was just the two of them. And I hope we can get some more of just the two of them holed up in the office sometimes.
When it says that Barkley and Hutchins were spending time with their families, it did remind me a little bit of when Strike was upset in Lethal White that he was the only unmarried one. So he was the one who had to give up his weekends. I just like that they're a pair here.
Yeah, they are the two of them, aren't they?
Robin continues her work to trying to get in with Shifty's PA, Gemma. And it says that her disguise today happened to be particularly good. And she'd sometimes had the satisfaction of seeing her partner double take before he realized who she was. And I'd love that.
I bet Robin loves it too.
Oh, I bet Strike loves it when she makes him do a double take. I bet he gets such a kick out of her fooling him and takes so much pride in her abilities. Unlike a certain person who shall remain nameless, who is always a dick about her wearing makeup and disguises.
Yeah, because she had to hide her contact lenses from Matthew and all that stuff. It's such a huge contrast between Strike and Matthew. So very different from each other.
Now we can get to the sneaky part with Robin infiltrating the nursing home. And I just have like a spy theme going on like in the background while I'm thinking about this. Like, da, 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 da.
I was instantly thinking of Pink Panther. Da, 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 da.
She's really thought about this. And I'm guessing part of her thought process is knowing a fight is going to come from it.
Yeah, I'll give her this. I think she's done a way better job at coming up with a plan than she did in Career of Evil. Because let's face it, her plan to go into Alyssa's house was just really awful. But here she's being cautious. She has a lot of information, which should be the right information. She just gets unlucky. But I think it really shows that she's been learning.
The whole scene with the dark wood paneled walls, the red carpet, which, by the way, is that a nod to Janice's red carpet?
I don't know.
The fact that her plan is already not working out correctly because the person she claimed to be visiting isn't on the same floor, it just sets the whole tone of tension. I was tense this whole time.
Yeah, it's a tense scene.
And Pools, I think your contrast of Ricci's life and Betty Fuller's life is further validated here because it actually does compare the two when it says it smelled better than her accommodations and the description of his room versus her room.
And when it talks about their persons too. So it talks about how clean he is, how groomed, how nicely he's set up with his blanket. I will say that all of the family photos and the kids' drawings, knowing what kind of a man he is, it gives me the creeps. The contrast of, oh, what a good family man with so many loving grandchildren. And this man filmed the gang rape and murder of a woman who was a police informer and instigated it. This man is a horrific human being, and here he is sitting surrounded by drawings that his grandkids have done for him, you know?
Robin let the door close quietly behind her, crept across to Ricci, and sat down on the end of his single bed, facing the one-time pimp, pornographer, and orchestrator of a gang rape and murder.
She must have felt so unnerved at this moment, staring at this man, knowing what he's done. Almost like Strike with Creed later in the book. Robin, too, gets her confrontation with an absolute psychopath.
Bad people also become old and weak and frail, and kind of like how we forget that Janice is a serial killer. Mm-hmm. It's easy to forget that this weak old man was once so dangerous. And I wonder if the people taking care of him have any idea.
They might know he has criminal connections because, I mean, look at his family that's visiting him, right? But no, they can't know. The scene is so tense, and then Luca shows up.
Oh yeah, everything with Luca is scary. I was half expecting this to be the one moment where Ricci starts talking just to contradict her. Thank God that didn't happen, but I was a little scared.
That would have been such a dick move. Like, God, now you talk? Come on. But Robin does such a good job here.
Yeah, we know how scared she was because it says that terror threatened to derail her plan. She starts sweating.
And worries about her hair chalk.
Not only does keeping her cool get her out of this mess, but I think it's also just another sign of how much work she's put into overcoming her trauma, because I don't think she would have been able to do this in Lethal White.
No, she might have had a panic attack if this had happened in Lethal White.
But six kids. God, could you imagine the amount of trauma that all of those kids together have endured? Just, I feel so bad for them.
Mm-hmm. I was a little worried about Luca, that he was suspicious of her. And that's why he was keeping her there. But I don't actually think that's what it was. I think this is just who he is. He had a chance to intimidate and scare a young woman, and he wasn't going to pass that up.
Absolutely. Because it gives him a thrill to just do that to a woman. He can tell that he's scaring Vanessa. He can see that Robin is scared because he's trying to scare her. So her fear is in character. The fact that he can see her fear is what kept her safe. Because if she'd been able to mask her fear and act like nothing was wrong, he might have been more suspicious of that than anything else, right? Like, why isn't this woman reacting to me the way she should be, right? And I like the way Robin thinks that even if she hadn't known who she was, she would have known what he was. Because if Robin would have known, then so would Vanessa Jones. This whole scene is by far the scariest in the novel. It's otherwise quite a risk-free book, with interviewing a lot of elderly people who don't really pose a threat anymore.
Well,
as long as you're smart enough not to drink the tea that they give you. I think the novel needed this scene to sort of keep us on our toes a bit and to get a bit of that, uh-oh, what's going to happen thing.
I mean, the entire chapter is suspenseful.
Yeah, the whole thing.
Even as they walk out, I felt like at any moment he could have just reached out and grabbed her. And when he called her name and said, you have to come sign back, I was like, oh my gosh.
Almost free. When he tries to get her in his car too, obviously Robin would never get in his car, but what would he have done to her if she had? Do you? I feel like this bit was setting up Luca and the Ricci's to come back in the future. Because they're organized crime, they're a presence in London. I could just see, he's so scary. He would make such a good villain in a novel.
I know you guys both feel that way. I know a lot of people do. I'm not as convinced. I think it's possible the Ricci's were just a red herring for this one.
Yeah.
But I don't know.
Well, I guess we just need book six to find out.
But how impressive. I mean, how scared she must have been. She finally got away. Mm-hmm. But she has it in her head that she's going to go back because she knew what she had found. Good for her.
Good for her.
Should we go on to 62?
Yes.
Chapter 62, Shrike and Robin come to an agreement over her risk-taking and talk to Anne and Kim, who have given up hope on finding Margot.
Aww.
The epigraph, oft times it haps that sorrows of the mind find remedy unsought, which seeking cannot find.
One's really clever.
Yeah, I like this one. I think it applies to both Shrike and Robin and to the Bamborough case. So, you know, it's saying that sometimes we find remedies to our troubles when we're not looking for them. Mm-hmm. And this fight that Robin and Shrike have over visiting Ricci, it's really been something that they've needed to have discussed since Career of Evil. Mm-hmm. But it's good for both of them, and it really allows their relationship and partnership to grow.
I agree.
I think you can apply it to the Bamborough case as well, because Anne and Kim in this chapter decide to end the investigation. So now that there's no pressure, they're not trying to find the answer. There's no pressure to find the answers. It's when they get some major breaks and that lead them to the killer.
Man, you're getting really good at these epigraphs. Not that you weren't always, but you are now an epigraph pro. I totally agree with all of that. 100%. It also, I mean, it's not in this chapter, but it just makes me think of how often Strike unconsciously finds a remedy to a sorrow by pressing Robin's name on his phone. He's not even consciously seeking it, just there's the remedy. But it's not at all relevant to the epigraph. It's just what it makes me think of.
We start out this chapter with Strike and Robin having the worst fight that they have ever had. Strike is pissed that Robin went to go see Ricci, and they are really angry.
Certainly the longest, an hour long fight, which ends with Robin slamming the door.
And him wishing he could have billed her for it. I love that.
So petty and so funny.
All right, was anybody genuinely concerned about what would happen here? Or were you just excited to see them finally resolve this issue as far as Robin taking risks and stuff?
I knew that once the actual fighting had resolved, like once the shouting argument had resolved and they hadn't broken up, as it were, I knew they'd be fine. It's in the heat of the moment that the risk is. So I wasn't too worried.
I was glad we didn't have to read about the whole fight because I really wouldn't have wanted to see another bad fight between them. I was just really happy with how this argument was resolved in this whole chapter in general, because this issue is something they've needed to address for a while. And I think that both of their fights, this one and in chapter 41, are so important for them to move forward in their relationship. Not only what the fights were about, but in how they resolved them. So I think the subject of each fight was important for Robin to get resolution on. She needed to address both of these things with him, and he needed to make the changes there. But for Strike, I think the makeup and resolutions themselves are good for him to experience, because he keeps claiming that things will go wrong. But if he just would look and see that Robin doesn't meet his expectations on how women behave, which are all based on Charlotte, they're able to have grown-up fights and grown-up resolutions where they don't further hurt each other, but they make healthy progress. So, no, I wasn't worried. I was really happy.
Yeah, I liked that we just skip over the fight and get to the good part, the making up.
Yeah, we've already seen one bad fight. I didn't need another.
I love this bit where Strike compares Robin's actions and career of evil to her actions now and thinks about how they're different. I love this. Above all, but this fact rankled rather than soothed, Robin was now a partner in the firm rather than a lowly subcontractor. For the first time, Strike was brought up against the hard fact that if they ever parted ways, a legal and financial tangle would engulf him. It would, in fact, be akin to a divorce. He didn't want to split from Robin, but his newly awakened awareness that he'd made it very difficult to do so increased his ire. So basically, Strike is realizing he's cluing into the fact that he and Robin are married. So
oops.
It's about time. Somebody should tell him.
And here's the proof for him right here that making something permanent doesn't mean it'll go bad. They're already building their lives together. They're already contractually bound to each other. This fight is probably the lens through which he's able to see that things with Robin are already permanent. I think another difference here than Career of Evil is how he's able to look at this and realize maybe where some of this emotion is coming from. In Career of Evil, it was a very emotional reaction, but I don't think that he was able to fully be honest about why he's having such an emotional reaction, where here he's starting to really see it.
I agree.
And Robin makes a great case for herself. It needed to be done and he couldn't do it. She's better at disguises. He doesn't get her permission to do things. And again, she calls him out when he needs to be called out. So she says, it isn't a bloody theory, Strike. It's reality. And you're just being pigheaded about it.
Hell yeah. Tell him what's what, Robin.
She generally is usually the one who actually has logic and reason behind her arguments. It's not the first time that she's won on points because she's right and he's being an idiot. For the most part, I feel like you're about to defend Cormoran. I see your I'm gotta defend Cormoran face coming on.
Well, when he says that what bothers him most is that she didn't tell him, I do agree with him. I think that she does need to tell him these things, but it's not a perfect agreement because I think she's right that he would have overruled it and that would have been the wrong choice. Mm-hmm. So yeah, Robin does need to tell him these things. Bench Strike does need to be more aware of his tendency to be irrational about it. Of course, this would be so much easier if they were in a place where he could just say that he worries about her because he loves her, but you know. We're not there yet.
Robin could also practice her, I am doing this, but he might not take that very well. But really, they are partners now, so he doesn't get to overrule her anymore. If he's not willing to discuss it rationally, then sucks to him, I guess.
I also love when he stops pretending that he's reading the notes. So relatable in an argument, isn't it?
Yeah, it is super relatable.
I don't care. I'm doing this other thing.
Fine, I'm not doing the other thing. Here's what I think. Yeah, I've done that about a million times too.
Robin leaves the room to go make tea. And it says, through the gap, Strike heard her talking to Pat, followed by the tinkle of mugs. Annoyed though he was, he still hoped she was going to get him a cup of tea as well.
Aww.
Which is cute, even through his annoyance.
Just a reference earlier, what she said about what do I have to offer him? Perfect cups of tea. It's like, well, look at how much it clearly means to him. Even when he's angry, he still wants that from her.
Yeah. It's not just that he wants tea in this moment. It's that he wants Robin to care for him enough, even though they're arguing that she'll still bring him tea.
But I think it's so funny that he's so stubborn because he knows that she's right, so much so that he contacts a handwriting analyst, but he still won't tell her.
And he knew right away, too. He knew while they were having that first hour-long argument, the second she showed him the picture. So we find out that Strike's spoken to Shanker, and he says Luca's last spell in jail, as Shanker told him, had been for ordering and overseeing a stabbing. The victim had been knifed in the balls. No need for details, Strike had said. He just experienced a nasty sensation radiating out of his own balls up to his chest.
I'm sorry, I'm a child. It's funny to me.
Balls. Yeah.
The way that he winces there at the end is just hysterical to me for some reason.
The way when he's like, please don't tell me more, Shanker. This is horrific. I'm wincing a bit even.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. I like that as these paragraphs progress, we really get the full picture of just how afraid he was. Calling Shanker on some pretense to try and see if there's any word. He's incredibly anxious about this.
Once Robin comes back and Strike finds out that she did, in fact, bring him tea as well. Because of course she did. She's an absolute angel.
Here she is carrying two cups again.
It's a sign. And she also sets the darker one of the two teas in front of Strike.
Yeah, I remember I found that really interesting because I think it's the first time that we find out how she takes her tea. Is that right?
Well, I've been mad that we don't know how Robin takes her tea for 5 books now. So yeah, I think it is the first time we find out. Or this book is. Yeah.
I just find it really sweet because, you know, when they go on road trips, she makes it for him. She makes it how he likes it.
It is sweet. It's also a bit self-sacrificing, isn't it? Surely he could put up with slightly lighter tea.
Well, I'm sure he would, but she just doesn't ask. He would,
but she doesn't ask. But I hope for one road trip he makes it the way she likes it. She deserves to drink tea that she enjoys as well sometimes on road trips.
Well, I just think the point of the tea making in this whole bit is that she's doing it to show she cares. So it is
the point. And you're right. And it is really sweet.
Just like the tea.
Just like the tea. Finally, Strike concedes once he's received his gift of tea. He concedes that he's an idiot.
Speaking of tea, it was exactly the way he liked it. Strong, sweet, and the color of creosote.
Aww.
I feel like I'm going on too much about the tea, but.
You're not. It's a symbol of their love. It's what he loves about her. Well, one of the million things that he loves about her. And it's also, it's how she shows she cares. So the tea really is a symbol of their love in its two cups. Unlike Charlotte's false coffee in her cups. That's not the beverage of love.
As we all know.
I suppose. I actually like coffee a lot more than tea, so.
You are in trouble now. You said it.
Oh dear, come after me.
They're still arguing a bit, and Strike says that her going in was reckless, and she cuts him off and says, could you explain to me why it was reckless when I did it, but not when you were planning to do it?
Mm-hmm.
And then later, because I'm less experienced, because you think I'll mess it up or panic, or that I can't think on my feet.
She's 100% right. He has no logical basis for thinking it's reckless for her, but not for him. No basis whatsoever, except he's in love with her and he doesn't want her around dangerous people.
Strike denies this and says that it's because he has a better chance of survival if Reggie comes at him with a baseball bat. But Robin immediately calls him out on his bullshit and reminds him that what Reggie actually does to people, like acid, electrodes, and knives.
Of course she's right, but he can't be rational about it. And mm-hmm. His feelings make it almost impossible.
Yeah, that train of logic kind of follows down into Matthew territory, and that's really not.
And he wouldn't want her to stop doing the job because Strike loves that she does the job with him. He loves her being his partner. He just also wants to, paradoxically, keep her perfectly safe at all times. Because he's in love with her. So he really needs to work that out, doesn't he?
Well, it's going to be so much easier when he can just be honest that mm-hmm. that's how he's feeling.
Yeah, because then they can work from a place of honesty to figure it out, right?
Yeah, I'd also like to point out that Robin also loves him, but she doesn't feel the sense of worry regarding the danger of their jobs about him. Mm-hmm. At least not that she's expressed yet. Obviously, if he was in danger, she'd be worried about him. But it's not quite the same thing. And I think there are a couple of things that play into that. One, I do understand Strike's point that as a man, he doesn't have to worry as much as a woman does about being attacked, that if Luca did come after him, he has a better chance. So I think that's partly fair. And two, he's always felt responsible for the safety of the women in his life, like Lucy or Leda. And I just think it's going to take some real honesty between them for him to be able to relax a little bit and trust in Robin's abilities, which he will and which he does. But you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. And I mean, Robin could be justly worried that he can't outrun a dangerous criminal, for example. But yeah, she does have that faith in his abilities that maybe comes from seeing him as the expert, the professional, the seasoned detective. I'm just thinking of when she can't believe he got into a fight with Amir, and he's like, what about some sympathy for me, your one-legged boss? And she's like, you're an ex-boxer. And he's like, 9 stone soaking wet, you're fine. It was the same as when she wasn't worried at all about Pippa trying to knife him. No sympathy, no worry, because she knows Strike can take care of himself, right? She sees him as a capable person. And I know Strike sees Robin as capable. He just doesn't quite trust that to keep her safe, I guess. I was going nowhere with that. I just makes me laugh when Robin has no sympathy or worry for Strike at all.
Well, I think she would if he was ever in actual danger.
I mean, he was sort of stabbed a little in the first novel.
Stabbed a little.
At least she didn't know he was in danger in Career of Evil. She's never had to experience him being held somewhere and not being able to get to him and being worried about what will happen. I'm really hoping that we get to see her start to worry a bit in book 6. Just because it's his turn to be in danger, I think.
It is his turn to be in some actual
danger. His turn to be in danger. I very much want him to face a little danger just so we can get the emotions of Robin being worried and then him being safe.
I really like how Strike brings up that Shanker had reminded him that if the answer to what happened to Margot was involved with anything to do with the Ricci's, then they needed to back off and leave it alone. And Robin immediately calls him on it and says, you don't mean that. I know you don't. You'd never choose not to know. I love that they know each other so well and that she knows these fundamental things about him that he would never choose not to know.
Yeah, and she's the same way.
We're finally coming up on the bit where he actually admits to himself that he's not in the right here. Indeed, one of the things that had kept his anger simmering for the past 2 weeks was that he knew there was a fundamental lack of logic in his own position. If trying to get information on the Ricci family had been worth doing at all, it should have been done. And as Robin had proven, she'd been the best person for the job. While he resented the fact that she hadn't warned him what she was about to do, he knew perfectly well that if she'd done so, he'd have vetoed out of a fundamentally indefensible desire to keep her out of harm's way, when the logical conclusion of that line of thinking was that she oughtn't to be doing this job at all. He wanted her to be open and direct with him, but knew that his own incoherent position on her taking physical risks was the reason she hadn't been honest about her intentions.
I think it's great. I don't know if this is something he could have reached this soon without being forced to look at it in the face like this. It's just such a significant barrier that they've crossed, and I'm really proud of how they concluded it and how honest he's being with himself that he's being unfair.
Yeah.
I just think it's really important for them moving forward in their relationship and their partnership. I'd love it if in a future book he tells her that part of the reason he was so angry was that he was just so scared.
Oh, I would love that as well. Yes, please. He has to acknowledge what the problem is before he can move forward to fix it, right?
Yeah.
So he has to be honest with himself about what's going on with him, why he's being so incoherent, before he can hope to fix it. Before they can hope to fix it. Which is why, again, yes, I agree with you that this fight is really important. Both their fights are really important. We love to see it. I mean, we don't love to see them fighting, but we love to see them making up, don't we?
Yeah.
So he continues thinking about why, you know, he's been so worried and everything. And he says he knew too much about her past. The relationship had become too personal. He didn't want to visit her in hospital again. He felt precisely the same irksome sense of responsibility that had kept him determinedly single, but without any of the compensatory pleasures. None of this was her fault, but it had taken a fortnight for him to look these facts clearly in the face. First, I appreciate that Joe enjoys colons and semicolons as much as I do, because good Lord, there are some long phrases there. But I'm interested to hear everybody's thoughts about this, because the first time that I read the relationship had become too personal, it kind of rattled me a little bit, because I think it's not personal enough.
Well, I think what he means is he's not saying it's too personal, so they need to go backwards, which seems like a cuckoo's calling Strike thing to say. I think he's saying he cares too much about her. He can't be objective about her being in danger because they have such a personal relationship. I mean, she's his best friend. He's in love with her. They have a deeply personal relationship. So it's clouding his judgment because he can't be honest about it. This is where I disagree with people when they say that a relationship between them would ruin the agency. I've seen this argued before. I think it's clear that it's happening, so it's going to be fine. But, you know, him not being able to be honest with her about his feelings for her is starting to become a problem with running the agency. It's actually the opposite of that.
Yeah, it's like what he said in Lethal White. If they're not honest with each other, they're screwed. And at this point, because he can't truly be honest with her or her with him, they are starting to get a little bit screwed by it. He needs to listen to his own advice.
The next part makes me laugh when it says it takes a supreme effort to admit that she had done so well.
But you know what? He makes that supreme effort. He does that. He didn't do that shit in Career of Evil. He was just being a grump the whole time when they had this argument. But here he says, you know what? She deserves to know that she actually did a really good job getting this evidence. So he
makes that supreme effort.
Girds his loins and he does it. He makes the effort.
The conclusion of this argument, if I'd asked you, yeah, I might have said no and I'd have been wrong. And I'll bear that in mind next time, okay? But as you keep reminding me, we're partners. So I'd be grateful. All right, said Robin. Yes, we'll discuss it. I'm sorry I didn't.
But I think that's both closure on that issue and growth, baby.
That's growth.
Love it.
I might be by myself on this one, but this is another argument where I can see both sides. And I love that they both admitted where they were wrong and both promised to do better in the future.
Yeah. I don't think you're totally in the wrong. Robin should have given him a heads up that she was about to go in there. If only so that if, you know, Luke ended up abducting her, he'd have a lead rather than having nothing.
We know at the end of the book, it says that he'd done a lot of thinking about Charlotte since her suicide attempt. And I wouldn't be surprised if some of that took place here. I see this as just another catalyst that pushes him to see what he has with Robin, what things were with Charlotte, and the differences between them, especially how they handle conflict in their relationship. Like I said at the beginning of this chapter, I think that the resolutions of these fights are so beneficial for Strike. They were angry for a long time, but they talked it out. She still showed she cares by making him tea. That bad that he worried about came in a little bit, as it does in any relationship, but they were okay. They didn't keep hurting each other. They made things better.
And there's also that she didn't walk out after the fight like Charlotte would. They still worked for those 2 weeks together. It was just a little bit tension filled, a little bit distant, but it showed that they can have these fights and still function as an office, like as an agency, right?
Yeah.
Which is another thing that I think would reassure him about the future.
But moving on, this is where Pat is at the door because Anna and Kim are on the phone.
That's a bit sad.
It does make me sad. They end the contract.
I really like this bit. After they've walked Anna and Kim through all they've learned and mentioned that they still have leads, but Kim says, I'm sorry, but no, we're not willing to extend this. Waiting for Anna to speak, Robin suddenly realized that her eyes were full of tears. She'd so very much wanted to find out what had happened to Margot Bamborough. Robin could tell Anna was crying too. She felt wretched.
It's just heartbreaking.
It is heartbreaking. I love Robin's empathy here. I mean, it's so sad, but we see Anna crying and it just makes the end of the novel better once we know what actually happens.
I guess I feel a little torn here because I respect that Kim has such good boundaries for herself, but I don't know, what would the harm have been about finishing up the last 2 weeks?
I think that the fact that they're about to go on a nice long vacation had a bit of a role in Kim saying, no, the 2 weeks, we don't need them. Like if Anna had been the whole time they're on vacation, counting down the days until the 2 weeks are up, hoping desperately that something might happen in those 2 weeks, when Kim clearly knows that no, nothing's going to happen or feels like nothing's going to happen. You know, it's horrible to say it would have ruined their vacation, but maybe Kim felt like it was better to make a clean break and have a fresh start.
I guess I would have felt the opposite if I was Anna. Yeah. I would have felt like we were giving up and my whole trip would have been ruined then.
Oh.
So that's why I feel like, why not just let them finish it out for her?
Maybe I'm more like Kim. Well, ultimately, in the end, we know that...
Yeah, this is also coming from a place of we know what happens. So
we know what happens, but we also know that Strike and Robin care too much and are not above doing a bit of pro bono work to solve their own curiosity and because they care about their clients. So Anna and Kim really picked the right agency for this, didn't they?
Oh, yeah, they did. But it is sad. And I think Strike is sad too. When he says he needs to pee, so he leaves the room, I think he needed a minute. I think he's also sad. We often look at how close to Margot Robin felt. And I don't think that Strike had the same connection, but I still think he cared about finding her justice and finding answers for Anna. So yeah, I think he's It's a bit sad here.
They both are.
But Robin's also determined.
Of course she is. That's our girl.
Yeah. Despite the fact that Anna and Kim are like, no, no more. Yeah, she's still very determined. And I love that about both of them, that they still haven't given up despite the fact that Anna and Kim have.
Robin reads through some statements here, and I don't know if they're all important or some of them are a bit of red herrings, but we get Gloria Conti's statement to Lawson about Theo, Ruby Elliott's statement to Talbot about the two women in the phone booth, Janice's statement to Lawson about Douthwaite, Irene's second statement to Lawson with her receipt from Oxford Street, and Brenner's statement to Talbot about just the night in general and Margot.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I think the two that are most important, I guess, to me are Ruby Elliott's statement about the phone booth, because that comes up later on and it's an important clue. Mm-hmm. And then Janice talking about Douthwaite. She says, I've been on speaking terms with Mr. Douthwaite since he was assaulted at the flats, but I wouldn't call him a friend.
Mm-hmm.
Sure, Janice.
So I don't know. Do either of you guys see any other clues in those statements?
I think there are a bunch of clues and a bunch of red herrings mixed in together. But I did see, we do get the Marks and Spencer receipt in Irene's statement. And we know that Marks and Spencer is a big clue to Claire's alias, but a very tricky clue to figure out. And I think, I don't know if there's anything actually relevant in the statement about Theo. I think maybe it's just a bit of a misdirection to make the reader wonder, like, are we back to Creed? Could Theo have really been Creed, right? But yeah, she's mixed in enough actual important clues here and enough red herrings to sort of keep the reader on their toes, I think.
When Shrike comes back, we had a bet, he said, about whether they'd extend the year if we had any outstanding leads. I said they would. You said they wouldn't. I'm not taking that, said Robin, leaving the fiver where it lay. There's still two more weeks.
They still had time.
There was still time.
There Aww. Was still time.
I've said it before, but I love how invested Robin gets in the case. And I love particularly in this book, how her being so involved in the case is so pivotal in her development.
I just think it's really cute that he remembered the bet that they made a year ago.
He remembers a lot.
Remembers a lot. That he was instantly willing to pay up on their bet. I liked that. I love the idea of them making little bets about the agency all the time. It's just adorable. But then we get back to the business of the agency.
Yeah, and the agency is taking on famous people. In this instance, a famous footballer. So I think that's great. I love seeing them taking on more high-profile clients and stuff. Look at them being the best agency in London.
I'm not surprised after the amount of publicity they've had. The minute any rich person in London is like, I need a PI, then they're going to be like, oh, that guy who did all the stuff on the news. Look him up.
There's this quote here. It says, he returned to the inner office and pushed up the window, allowing the afternoon air, heavy with exhaust fumes and London's particular smell of warm brick, soot, and today a faint trace of leaves, trees, and grass to permeate the office. I just like how poetic this is. It feels comforting to me somehow. Mm-hmm. And I think I'm seeing Strike maybe feeling a little wrung out. Even though he and Robin made up, it was still a lot of self-reflection and emotion that went on. And then with the Bamborough case ending, I don't know, it just feels very peaceful and he needs a little bit of peace.
It does. It feels like it's connecting him. It's grounding him with the bigger world right there, right? Like all of London is out there. The natural world is out there. You're still a part of it all, right? I agree. It's a really evocative description.
So Strike kind of muses over Ricci again, saying that he's a plausible suspect. Could be a professional hit done for some inscrutable underworld reason because Margot got too close to a secret or interfered in the gangster's business. So I'm curious, did either one of you suspect Ricci as a suspect? And why or why not?
No, but not because I was looking at actual clues, but just because I felt like it was going to be someone we weren't suspecting at this point.
Yeah. It's never the most plausible suspect, is it? Yeah. Like at this point in the book, who looks like a good suspect is obviously not the murderer.
Yeah. I mean, yeah.
That's meta reading right there. That's just not the way the mystery is structured.
Although I do like this line in that quote that you just read, Kenz, where it says, because Margot had got too close to a secret. Mm. And Shrike is actually right about the motive. He's just doesn't have the right person.
It speaks a lot to who Margot was, and Strike has clearly got a sense of who she was, the same as Robin has, that she would be prying into stuff and getting close to secrets. And this quote, when he thinks about the letters, leave my girl alone, She'd been the type to advise a stripper or a hooker or a porn actress or an addict to choose a different life, to give evidence against men who abused her. I just really like that summation of Margot's character.
She was really brave. She had a lot of enemies because she did what she thought was right.
Yeah, she did what she thought was the right thing for the right reasons. So maybe she has some kinship with Strike too. I love Margot. She's my favorite of all of the victims. I know that sounds weird, but I'll say it again.
No, I know what you mean.
Speaking of kinship with Strike, though, we have some Pat and Strike bonding time. And we learn why Pat took against Strike, which is hilarious.
Oh, this is so funny.
Strike says thanks very much to Pat. And it says she looked vaguely surprised to hear his thanks. But ever since Robin had shouted at him for being rude to Pat, Strike had been consciously trying to be politer to the secretary. For a moment, she hesitated, electronic cigarette between her yellow teeth, then removed it to say, Robin told me what Morris did, what he sent her. Yeah, said Strike, sleazy bastard. Yeah, said Pat. She was scrutinizing him closely, as though seeing things she hadn't ever expected to find.
Aww.
I love that.
I love it too. I like that we get the little notice that yes, Strike is trying to be polite.
I don't know how I hadn't noticed it. It was probably because I was racing through to get to who the killer was, I think, at this point. But I had never noticed that Pat had said Morris looked like a young Mel Gibson, which is, I guess, I mean, that's a very particular mental image. But I don't know. To me, it made that just a little bit more impactful that, like, you know, if Morris is a, I mean, I would think young Mel Gibson is like a conventionally handsome guy, I guess.
I had to Google young Mel Gibson because all I think of when I think of Mel Gibson is like current day fucking crazy Mel Gibson. Like, same. I'm like, Mel Gibson, really? But you Google him, and yes, when he was young, he was actually quite good looking. And then Pat says, and this is the real gold, funny thing, looks, she said, you make assumptions. I suppose, said Strike. You've got a real look of my first husband, Pat told him. Is that right? Said Strike, startled.
I love this it. Is this why, is hilarious.
For the whole book, she's hated Strike because he looks like her first husband.
I love it so much. It killed me the first time I read that.
I mean, his rudeness probably didn't help, but no. Yeah, she's probably projecting some of her ex's personality onto him.
Oof, makes me wonder what her first husband was like.
Big and sexy. But yeah, I was very happy to see this between them, even though it's funny. It's great because mm-hmm. I think that things are going to be different and probably better for Robin.
Yeah, God, give Robin a break. But I do think that their relationship will be better going forward. I think they'll keep the funniness and the banter and the sarcasm, but it'll be in a much more friendly way.
Yeah.
And I'm really looking forward to it.
Me too. Almost like I'm really looking forward to book 6 for some reason.
For can't some reason. That. Almost like you're really looking forward to being done with all of this astrology and tarot stuff.
Will you ever let me be done with it?
I mean, I personally know. I'm stuck on it now.
Speaking of, though, we have to look at Talbot's notebook. Strike looks over the final page, which I think is pretty poetic because it says that he's looking over Talbot's last page as he too reached the end of this investigation.
Mm-hmm.
But this drawing is...
It's a lot.
This drawing is a lot. Yeah. He talks a lot about poison and cups in it.
Yep.
I think the most interesting one to me is when it says 7 with 7 heads, 7 streams, 7 letters in her name, 7 times.
Yeah.
I think that's a big clue. Janice has 6 letters, but Beatty has 7.
Mm.
So that could very easily mean her. And then the 7 times, he interviewed her 7 times. So I think he was onto something. He just couldn't articulate it.
I agree. The 7 is pretty significant. All of the poison, all of the blood. I think this was his subconscious trying to speak to him that he'd found something suspicious about Janice, but wasn't letting himself see it because it didn't fit his expectations of who the butcher was.
Yeah, I mean, if anybody has any other ideas of what some of these things could mean, please let us know because it kind of all goes over my head unless it's really obvious.
Yeah, I think that you pointed at the most important things.
Yeah, some of it might deliberately be nonsense too, just to...
Yeah, of course. The ending of the chapter, just like we were talking about with the epigraph, now that the pressure's gone, Strike is finally allowing himself to think, maybe there's something actually here. Maybe I can find some answers and learn something from this.
Mm-hmm. I love that last line, salvage clues from chaos, sense from madness, and the desperate effort of a good detective. Well, now he's got two good detectives who are finally putting order into this chaos after 40 years. But yeah, the pressure's off. And so Strike can get into that sort of headspace of, I'm just going to let the connections make themselves without having to push them. And that's when it starts working for them.
I know these chapters can't compare to last time, but I do enjoy these chapters. I do enjoy these chapters. I think mm-hmm. there's a lot of good stuff in them.
Yeah. For three fairly short chapters, there's a lot of growth and important stuff happening here, right?
Yeah.
And we're kind of inching ever closer to the climax of the book. So
we are so close.
We are so close.
We're like 10, 11 chapters away at this point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wow.
Now that is wild to think about. Okay, that'll do it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back in 2 weeks for a discussion of chapters 63 through 65. If you enjoy what you've heard so far, don't forget to follow us on social media. We're on Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr at the SE Files Pod with regular updates announcing future episodes. If you'd like to send us a response to anything you've heard or have something you'd like us to discuss on the show, you can always email us at sefilespodcast@gmail.com. Thank you so much again for listening, and we hope to catch you next time for another episode of the Strike and Ellicott Files.